you make every game a life and death proposition, you're going to have problems. Dean Smith.
Kind of a weird thing happened. You know, we have our ice axes, and as coming down, my son found an extra ice axe just kind of lying in the snow. So he carried it for a little while, and then he gave it to me. So I'm kind of going down with two ice axes. I slipped and fell on my back, and when I hit the ground, I dropped one of the ice axes, but I still had another ice axe. And then I started to slide on my back, you know, head up, feet down, and I took off like a rocket. And I executed the most perfect rollover self-arrest. The guide later told me that he saw his whole career flashing before his eyes because I stopped probably about, you know, 20 to 30 feet from just these massive piles of rocks. It would have been bad.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the Trail, Dirtbags, and Hiker Trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right, this week we are talking to a peak bagger with an extraordinary resume. Joining us from the northeastern United States today is Michael Cole. Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Michael, how's it going?
It's going really good. Thank you for having me.
And as we are speaking, it is about 6 p.m. here on the east on the West Coast, and you are up past your bedtime. So I appreciate you staying awake and being able to talk to me tonight.
Yeah, no, if I nod off, just I don't know what you do when people nod off, but do it. But I'm not going to nod off.
Okay, all right. I'll try and keep it entertaining so you stay awake.
Okay, that's partly my job too, I think.
Now you are a friend of two previous guests on the podcast, aren't you?
I am.
And who would those guests be?
Yeah, you would know them as the Professor and Stretch, and I guess they're known jointly as the Suffer Buddies. And they were on your podcast, I want to say June or July of 22.
That's right. The Suffer Buddies, Kucharski and Kanosh, I believe, are the last names there.
That's them. Yeah. I hike with them. I hike with Mike Kucharski more than Jason. But we've actually been on a few pretty decent hikes. I don't suffer as much as I suffer in different ways. I suffer trying to keep up with them because they're both like over 6 feet, closer to like 6'3", and I used to be 5'7", and now I'm like 5'6". So they have a long stride. So I suffer to keep up. They're suffer. You know, they like to do like 20 and 25 mile, 30 mile hikes a day. And I don't join them on those.
Yeah, that's just a lot more steps for us shorter guys, right? I mean, they've got long strides. They can cover a lot of ground. And be forewarned, you younger people out there, that when you do get to be our age, you tend to shrink a little bit. Your spine compresses. You're not as tall as you used to be.
Yeah, you could deny it as much as you want, but it's true.
Yeah, when my kids asked me, how tall are you? I said, well, I used to be 5'9" and a half. I'm sure I'm not quite there anymore. So,
yeah, it happens.
Well, in your travels with Kucharski and Kanosh, did you pick up a trail name?
So, I'm not a through hiker. I've done a fair amount of hiking on the Appalachian Trail, but I'm not a section hiker. So the technical answer to your question is I do not have a trail name, but I did know that you were going to ask me that question. Some of my hiking crew does refer to me as, it's not a good trail name, but they call me the Wilderness Father.
That's a lot of syllables right there.
I know. That's why it's not a good trail name. but That's about as close as you're going to get. But I don't know if you want to refer to me as that during the podcast, because that takes a lot of time.
Wilderness Father. What if we shorten that to just Pops?
Yeah, that would probably be apropos.
You know, we'll try out a couple of things tonight. All right, we'll see what feels good, what sticks. I'll start off with Pops, and we'll see if from your stories and experiences we can maybe pick something else.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, hey Pops, have you listened to the podcast before?
I've listened to the Suffer Buddy episodes, and I've listened to a few others just to kind of make sure I was a little oriented before we started.
So you knew what you were getting into.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, knowing
unless you're changing the flipping the script or changing the script.
You know, knowing your former profession, I wouldn't expect any less. I would expect you to do your research and be prepared coming in.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
That's correct.
I only ask because I want to make sure that you are familiar with a segment we have towards the end of the episode called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week. That's where I will turn to you and ask you to share some trail wisdom with our listeners to make their next experience even better.
Okay.
All right.
I'm prepared for that.
Okay, good. And, you know, feel free to drop trail wisdom throughout the episode, but don't use up that one that you're prepared to give at the end. You'll still be on the hook for that at the end.
Okay.
All right.
I have a few, so I could.
Oh, sorry. Half calf talked over you there. What'd you say, Pops?
I said, I have a little bit of trail wisdom. So if I drop one early, I'll still have one in my pocket.
Okay. All right. Okay. So that was Half Calf a little bit earlier, and she is reminding us that it is time to do the must bring gear review sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company, Six Moon Designs. And here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day hike, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So Pops, what is your must bring piece of gear out there when you're with the Suffer Buddies?
Okay. I do hiking all year round, but what I really prefer is winter hiking. And so with the risk that you've probably heard this before, I would say my must bring piece of gear has to be microspikes. I used to use Cotula microspikes, but if you know anything about microspikes, you know, as opposed to crampons, you really can't sharpen microspikes. Once they kind of get dull, you throw them out. So my Cotulas are kind of kaput, and I've switched to Hillsound trail crampons, which I think are, I kind of like them better. But regardless, for hiking in the Whites, in the Adirondack, and the Appalachian Trail in the winter, you have to have your traction.
Okay. And for our listeners out there who may be unfamiliar with winter hiking and what micro spikes and crampons are, what's the difference between micro spikes and crampons?
Okay. So my crampons are really more for what I would classify as serious mountaineering, glacier, a little bit more of an angled ascent. They'll often have two points or spikes in the front, so you can actually pick your toes right into the ice if you're going up something that's really steep. They're a little bit less pliable, crampons, longer spikes, 10 to 12 spikes per foot. And you can strap them on or you could clip them on. The micro spikes are much more user friendly. They can go, you could put them on trail runners. You could put them on sneakers. You could put them on winter boots. You just kind of slide them on. They have like this rubberized, stretch kind of material that will just pull right over your boot. They probably have about 12 to 15 spikes, but they're smaller. So a crampon might have a 1-inch spike. A Cotula micro spike may have a 1/2 inch. The ones that I use, the Hill Sounds, have like a 2/3 of an inch. So that's why I like them. They're a little bit more aggressive. they're just a great piece of gear for lower angled, less of an inclined going up and going down. And in winter, you got to have it. You just have to have it.
Yeah.
More serious climbs. Yeah. More serious climbs, I'll use crampons.
So, Pops, would it be fair to say that if you're going to do some winter hiking, you really need to know the environment you're going into and make sure that you're prepared? I mean, we've heard stories on this podcast of folks who maybe did not have crampons or micro spikes or an ice axe, and they find themselves in situations that are literally life and death situations.
100%. And I see it almost every time I'm out, especially when I'm in the White Mountains, which could be pretty nasty. I mean, a lot of hikers, a lot of climbers, serious mountaineers. So I've climbed out in the Cascades, and I've climbed in Alaska, and I've climbed up in the lower Cascades in California. But anyways, a lot of mountaineers will train in the winter up in the Presidentials in New Hampshire, because, I mean, it's the worst weather in the world. And I've seen just about every hike, especially in the winter, I've seen people in hoodies, in sneakers, in trench coats, with book bags, and you name it, I've seen it. And you just kind of shake your head. And sometimes it's to the point where, especially if I'm coming down and I know what it's like above treeline, and I see somebody heading up, you know, we'll kind of like pull them aside and say, you might want to rethink this, because it's pretty serious up there. So yeah, you definitely have to be watching the weather, and you have to be smart enough to know that if it's going to be bad, the mountain's always going to be there. You come back another day. And, you know, we bring our GPS, we bring our backup, we bring our map, we bring our compass, and we do our homework. We check the avalanche report if we're traveling in avalanche terrain. And so, yeah, you just have to do it. I mean, you could be lucky. I mean, most times you're going to be lucky and you're going to make it if you're not prepared. But I'd rather be prepared. And in the Whites, I mean, in the last several months, there's been people who've lost their lives up there who were not prepared.
Yeah, I've heard about some stories in the Whites, and also down here in Southern California, we've got some peaks that are snow covered. Right now, like Mount Baldy, there's been a number of folks who have ended up on the short end of the stick on Mount Baldy. Right now, I know they're looking for an actor as we record this right now. There's been an actor who has gone missing in the Mount Baldy area about 2 weeks ago, and they're still looking. And in the course of looking for him, they found a couple of other bodies. I mean, it is a dangerous situation if you don't have the right equipment. It could be dangerous.
And that's, you know, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I like winter hiking so much. I mean, it's definitely a little bit more on the risk continuum, which makes it a little bit more exciting. But you got to be smart about it, because my wife would be really pissed.
All right. We are early in the episode talking about the risk continuum. So this is going to be a good episode, I can tell already.
Okay, good. I like continuums.
It's the hiking pole.
All right. To help us determine your total, where you fall on the risk continuum, this is the hiking pole. Mm-hmm. And that's pole, P-O-L-L, like a survey. This is a 7-question survey that's going to help me give you a score on the sanity scale from 1 to 100, with 1 being completely insane and 100 being completely sane. You ready for this?
All right. I am ready.
Okay. How would the professor rank you on the sanity scale? Where would he say you fall?
Oh, he'd say I'm like a 90.
Very sane.
Yeah. So they call me the wilderness father.
That's right. So you understand the risk. You understand the risk continuum, and you take the proper precautions.
As much as you can, right? I mean, because there's always that little bit of an unknown. I try. Let's say I do try.
Okay. Now this survey is completely subjective. Your score at the end will be derived upon whether or not I agree with you.
Okay.
And I get to do that because I'm the host.
I know.
Okay. So let's start off easy here. First question. Trekking poles or no trekking poles out there while you're peak bagging? It's a long pause. Poles, that's a long pause. I know. Already. Let me mark that down. Okay, go ahead.
Trekking poles 9 times out of 10 on the way up. Usually on the way down, but sometimes they kind of get in the way on the way down. You know, on the one hand, my old aching knees kind of could use the trekking poles, kind of reduce the shock. But a lot of times they're kind of just getting in the way. But I would say I am a trekking pole.
Okay. All right. Question number two, what's on the feet, boots or trail runners?
Boots. I'm a boot guy.
You're a boot guy.
So in the winter, if I'm going above tree line, it's double plastic boots.
What are double plastic?
And
tell me about double plastic boots.
Well, they're mountaineering boots. So there's an insert. It's like kind of like a poly foam insert. Goes inside the boot. The outside is just a big it's a plastic shell. And there's this, it's not a neoprene liner, but it almost looks a little bit like a neoprene liner that slides into the boot. Keeps your feet warm as hell. They're a little clunky. They're great for attaching crampons too. Give you pretty good traction. So a lot of mountaineers will use them. Plastic boots are kind of old school. There's a synthetic kind that's new. They're a little bit more comfortable, but they're more expensive. I didn't feel like springing for it. But I've had my pair, I don't know, 10 years now. So they're really good for overnights in pretty severe winter conditions. Because what you can do is you take the liner out because your feet sweat, right? If you just have a single liner boot, it's going to freeze at night. And it's going to be miserable the next morning when you slide your foot in. The double boot, you take the liner out and you stick it in the sleeping bag with you. And it's nice and toasty in the morning when you put it back on. So that's a winter above tree line boot. Below tree line boot is just a insulated boot. The rest of the year, I'm kind of in a solo fugitive mid, you know, ankle high boot.
Okay.
No trail runners.
Do you still have all 10 toes?
Yeah.
Well, it's tough to argue with that then. I mean, I was going to mark you down. But, you know, if you've got 10 toes and you're hiking in that kind of environment, I mean, it kind of makes sense.
Like I said, I'm a 90.
All right. Hey, question number three. Do you ever do any overnights out there?
I've done overnights, you know, in Alaska, in the Cascades, in the Whites, not as much, more day hikes. Or if we're staying out, a lot of times we'll stay at a hut, mm-hmm. which are cold, but they're, you know, there's a shelter.
Right. So on the overnights, question number three is, what do you use for your shelter system? Is it a tent, tarp, hammock, bivy, or cowboy camping? This is the winter edition of the hiking pole. So this is
okay.
This
winter edition. I use a inflatable. I use inflatable pad. Then I use a closed foam cell pad on top of that. No, actually, that goes underneath. Then the inflatable pad. Then the 0-degree sleeping bag, and then the tent.
Okay, so it is a tent.
It's a tent.
Definitely a tent in the winter conditions.
I mean, I've slept. Maybe we'll get into this down the line. I have slept in snow trenches and snow caves before, but only when told to.
Okay, let's put a pin in that because I do want to talk about that later. So don't forget about that. All right. So that was question number three. You also answered question number four because you said I was going to ask sleeping bag or quilt. You say sleeping bag. And is it rated to, you say 0 degrees?
0 degree. Yeah.
0 degrees. Down or synthetic?
Down. Well, when I was in Alaska a year and a half ago, I wish I had a 20 degree because it wasn't fun. It was cold.
You wish you had a 20 or a minus 20?
Minus 20.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. All right. Now, how about when it comes to food out there? Are you stove, cold soak, or stoveless?
I am pretty Spartan when it comes to food. I will usually take some freeze-dried food with the stove. I'm a stove guy.
Okay.
But, you know, I have been known back in the day to eat my meals right out of the can cold. I don't mind it, as long as, I don't mind it. Sometimes I even like it.
What's your go-to freeze-dried meal out there?
Kind of like a pad thai.
Oh, okay. You know, of all the things that I was expecting to come out of your mouth, pad thai was not one of them. That's interesting.
It's pretty good. Yeah. In the morning is oatmeal, you know. Maybe I'll throw some almonds or some raisins or some whatever in it. But yeah, for dinner, it's usually like a pad thai kind of a thing.
I like it. I like it. All right. Question
number. And the good thing about the winter. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Good thing about the winter is what?
Nature's refrigerator. So you could bring, you know, meat, chicken, beef, like shredded beef, that kind of thing. It doesn't go bad, you know?
Yeah. So. You can bring that side of beef out there with you and not worry about it going bad. You go the whole.
That's where the Suffer Buddies come from. Like they carry my heavy stuff.
It's in their name. They should suffer.
Right.
All right. Question number 6, is life better above or below the tree line?
Above. Yeah. Oh, it's like walking on the moon in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Not that I've ever been on the moon, but it's just, you can't describe it. I mean, you'll take videos and people will look at it on Facebook or on your phone and they'll be like, oh, that's cool. And you hear the wind whistling and you can kind of see the snow flying horizontally. But until you're like standing in it, it's amazing. It's brutal, but it's amazing.
It's a certain attraction to that level of desolation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd much rather do a hike where there's a little bit of an adventure than a bluebird day in the winter.
Yeah, something a little bit further down on the risk continuum.
I guess so.
Maybe your trail name is Risky.
A little bit of a thrill seeker, I guess.
Yeah, I like it. Okay. Last question. What's more important, pack weight or luxury items?
Pack weight is more important than luxury items, but I always take more than I need. I don't mind humping the heavier weight. A lot, most times, whatever I'm, you know, the extras are just in the bag, but they're there in case I need it. But so I don't know where that leaves me. If that's luxury or pack weight. They're not luxury items that I'm, you know, dragging around for the most part.
Yeah.
Except every once in a while, you know, a few 16-ounce beers and a flask might find their way in. And I will hike that.
As you should. Absolutely. Now I've found with former military guys, and I know you were in the military, I have found with former military guys that they like to have a backup or even a backup for the backup, you know, just in case, to be prepared.
Yeah, we had an old saying, two is one. You've heard this, and yes. One is none.
That's right.
And yes, it's true.
Now, Pops, do you pack your fears?
Do I pack my fears?
Yes.
F-E-A-R-S?
That's correct. You know, there's a tendency in the hiking community to pack your fears. If you're afraid of running out of water or running out of food or afraid of being cold, you tend to overpack in those areas. You take more than you should. And it's because of what you fear.
Okay. Maybe a little bit when it comes to the hands. I mean, I'll take more different kinds of gloves with me and, you know, hand warmers because that's the one, like I said, my boots are great. My layering system is great, but I'm always a little bit concerned about the hands. And so maybe I take a few extra pair of gloves and I probably need to, but they don't weigh that much. So,
all right. Well, we have your answers. I need now to put your answers through the John Freaking Mirpod algorithm to come up with a score. I do a little math here. So we have to, let's see, I got to carry the two, going to multiply by pi, divide by root three, and we're going to adjust for the wind chill of minus 80 at the top of Mount Washington a few weeks back.
That's a good day.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. And I come up with, you know, a fairly sane score of 72.
I told you, that's kind of where I thought I would kind of end up.
Yeah, your wife wouldn't be surprised?
She'd be happy. No, she wouldn't be surprised. She comes on some of these, too. There's a few stories there, too. But she's a good trooper.
Do you have a trail name for her? Be careful. Be careful. She might be listening.
I don't have a trail name.
Okay. That's probably for the best.
Yeah. You almost had me say something. I probably would regret it. So I do not have a trail name for her.
And I would have told you, oh, don't worry about that. We can edit that out. And then I would have left it in for you. Nice. All right. Hey, Pops, before we get too far down the trail, how is Pops feeling? Is it kind of growing on you, or we want to keep looking?
I kind of like it. Short, sweet, kind of captures the wilderness father vibe, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So Pops, before we get too far down the trail or too high up towards the peak, let's back up a little bit. Love to hear about where you grew up, play sports and hobbies when you were in high school, and how did you get involved in the outdoor adventure cult?
Yeah, so high school, I'm from Connecticut, Southern Connecticut originally, near New Haven, near Yale. Football in high school, college, football first year, but I was too small. Then I went to cross country running, which that sucked. And then I found my niche in playing rugby. And then in college,
now hang on, Pops. I don't want to gloss over. I don't want to gloss over rugby, because I've got some friends who have played in the past, and it looks like a fascinating sport. I am very familiar with American football. There is some similarity, but what are the big differences between rugby and football?
Well, for one, you don't have a helmet, or shoulder pads. You play the whole game. The only way you can get out is an injury. There are no substitutes. The best part of rugby is the parties after the rugby game, because you go out and you party with the opposing team, which you don't do when you're playing, you know, high school or in college football. So it's a great sport. It's an intense sport, and there's just a lot of camaraderie and a lot of fun.
Yeah, the fact that they don't wear helmets and they don't wear shoulder pads, do you think that lessens the safety or it increases the safety? Because what I see in American football, especially at the college and pro levels, because they have that equipment on, they are lowering their heads and just trying to, you know, deliver huge, huge hits. And that ends up with people getting hurt. I think the fact that rugby players don't have helmets or face masks or shoulder pads, that kind of, you know, they're not going to lead with their head. They're not going to do the same kind of damage. Am I wrong thinking?
No. I think I agree. I mean, there's not a lot of headhunting in rugby. I mean, every once in a while you might get clotheslined, but there's no head to head unless it's by accident. You're not really using your head to tackle like you do in football, using your shoulders. You know, you're really going for the lower body. Maybe not so much the lower. Either part, every part of the body is fair game. But I think, I had a couple of concussions playing rugby, but that's because I caught a knee in the head, not because, you know, I was hitting somebody with my head. But I think overall, you'll see less injury, significant injury.
All right. I'm glad we agree on that. You've just gone up to a 74.
Yep. Thank you. Okay. Maybe we'll get to 90.
Could be. We'll see how it goes. But I interrupted you. Tell us more about your background.
Oh, yeah. So maybe my first real significant, I guess, outdoor experience was when I was going to school in Ithaca. I went to Ithaca College, which is across the street, so to speak, from Cornell. Used to hang out at Cornell a lot. And back in the day, you know, before we had the internet, the way you advertise yourself is you hung stuff in a, you know, on a bulletin board in a public place. And there was a sign. There was this Cornell professor, he was a veterinarian, who said he would take, if you're interested, he would take you to the Shawana Gunks in New York and teach you how to rock climb. He had this big van. So me and my buddies just, you know, pulled the little chit off the sign and called him up on the phone and said, you know, would you take us? And he's like, absolutely. You know, and he piles you into his van and he takes you down to the Gunks and he teaches you how to rock climb. And we go shoot pool and drink after the, you know, every night. And so I kind of fell in love with rock climbing. I'm not much of a rock climber, but that kind of got me into the outdoors. And then after college, I went in the Marine Corps, and that's kind of where I really started getting into the outdoors because I had to. I was an infantry officer, so
that's great.
I had a pack on my back.
You know, Pops, you just lost a whole generation of our listeners when you talked about a message board and tearing off the chits at the bottom. They have no frame of reference for that. They're like,
I know, but I'm watching you, and you did.
Oh, I did, absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about your military experience. What branch of the military are you in?
I was in the Marine Corps.
Hoorah!
Hoorah! Certify.
And that was what years? How long were you in?
I was active duty 1981 through 85. And then I was active reserves from like 85 to maybe 88 or 89. Then I went to law school. So I got out.
Okay.
I was in active reserves for a little while, but yeah.
Any deployments?
Oh, yeah. I went to Westpac's. Western Pacific, so Okinawa, Japan, Korea, Philippines, been to Panama, deployed to Norway, went to a pretty cool school in Norway for winter warfare, and I might be forgetting a couple. I spent more time overseas than at Camp Lejeune.
Nice. Now, first of all, thank you for your service. Tell us a little bit about the winter warfare school in Norway.
Okay, so my battalion was going to be participating in an exercise. I think it was Teamwork 84, 85. And that's a joint exercise with a lot of our NATO partners. And since we were going to be going over to Norway, there are a few slots for infantry officers to go and learn winter warfare from the best in the world, which were the Norwegians. And so there's this school in a little town called Elverum, Norway, which is like on the Norwegian-Swedish border. And I got tagged to go for my battalion, along with maybe two or three of my buddies. And the Norwegians teach it once a year, I think, in English. And so it was Marines, British commandos, Dutch, Danes, Germans, Swiss. I might have forgotten a few. And, you know, and what they did, and it's like a 6 or 7 week course. And you get there and you dump all your gear and they reissue you Norwegian gear. And for the first week, they teach you how to ski on what we used to call NATO planks. It's kind of like a backcountry, cross-country ski. And then they teach you how to live and maneuver and fight in the cold. And that's kind of where the snow trench and the snow cave came into effect. And ate Norwegian rations, which are almost inedible. But it was a great experience, you know? I mean, it was just really cool. We had reindeer running through our camp, and the Norwegians eat some weird stuff, but they're very, you know, they're very nice people, and just a great experience. So we were there for 6 or 7 weeks while the battalion was doing its training in the States, and then it kind of shipped over by ship. And we met them when they right outside Norway for the exercise.
Now, Pops, they always say that all the Norwegian countries, the Scandinavian countries, always rank high in terms of level of happiness, you know, happy with their lives, happy the way everything is going. And you would think that in the Scandinavian countries that their rations would be a lot more edible, because that you know, the almost inedible rations would indicate to me it's a certain level of unhappiness.
Well, these are Norwegian soldiers. I mean, the Norwegian people are probably very happy. The Norwegian soldiers, I don't know, maybe they like it. It was like freeze-dried sawdust. It was just, it had a ton of calories. You know, it probably had like 5 or 6,000 calories in a meal. And what we would do in the morning when we were out in the field, you know, you're sleeping in a tent, you'd get up in the morning, 06, 07. Can I say friggin'? It's friggin' cold.
You can say friggin',
it's too cold. Okay. It's too cold to eat. So you break down your camp, you pack up, and you'd ski for like 3 or 4 miles, cross-country ski, until your body got warm. And then you'd stop, and then you'd have your breakfast. And by then, you're so hungry. And you have everything kind of stuffed in your body, like your water, so it didn't freeze. You can kind of wolf it down. But.
Yeah, I can kind of see the wisdom in that, because, you know, Pops, when I'm having a good meal, I am really focused on the food. I'm enjoying it. I'm having good conversation. I'm not really paying attention to what's going on around me. So the Norwegian soldiers in this winter warfare school, I mean, they're good at what they do because they don't pay any attention to the food. Sometimes they don't even eat. It's so bad they don't eat. They're just going to do their job and get it done.
Yeah, they're very good at it. They're very good teachers. I made a couple of great friends between the Norwegians and the different nationalities that I was training with. Incredible experience and beautiful country. Yes, I mean, I want to go back. My wife and I are actually talking about going back, but we won't sleep in a snow cave.
At least I thought that was part of the allure.
Nah, he likes a bathroom.
Got it. Enough said. Now, you didn't only just participate in winter warfare school. You also participated in mountain warfare school and jungle warfare school.
Yeah.
Try saying that 3 times fast. I can barely get that out of my mouth. That was good.
Yeah. Mountain warfare school is in Korea. Mm-hmm. And jungle warfare school was in Panama. And as uncomfortable as winter warfare school and mountain warfare school are, jungle warfare school just sucks the most. Just the worst. Being in the jungle, you could have that. There's just no fun there. You're always wet, because it always rains for a couple hours, and then it's so humid you never dry out. And there's so many things that could just like mess up your day in the jungle. You know, in the cold you get cold, but in the jungle there's poisonous ants and frogs and snakes and sloths and monkeys, and it's just a mess.
Okay, so on the suckiness continuum, I want you to place these different items. I want you to winter warfare school, mountain warfare school, jungle warfare school, and hiking with Kucharski. Where do those fall on the suckiness continuum?
Okay, suckiness. So jungle warfare school sucks the most.
Most sucky, okay.
That's the furthest right on the continuum. Then you've got winter warfare school. That's the next worst. Mountain warfare school is actually kind of fun. And where do we stick Kucharski and Panache? I'd put them, I like those guys. They're all the way to the left. They're
far
easy.
Far left. Far left. Got it. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you got out of the military and went to law school. How did that whole law experience pan out for you? Where did that particular path take you?
Yeah, I had a good career. I'm retired now. I retired in October of 21. But so I started out as a federal prosecutor with the United States Department of Justice in New York. And I did primarily antitrust cases and some criminal tax cases. But the commute was 2 hours each way because I lived in Connecticut. And that was New York City. And so I did that for about 6 years. And I vowed that I would never actually add up how much time I spent on the train and the subway. And I still haven't to this day because it would be very depressing. And then I moved careers, and then I went with the Connecticut Attorney General's office. And I was a civil prosecutor. With DOJ, I was criminal and civil, and I ended up running the last 16 years of my career. I ran the antitrust department, and then for the last 6 years, I ran the antitrust department and antitrust and the government program fraud department, which is primarily healthcare fraud. So I was basically a prosecutor my whole career. Had some pretty good cases, had some great people that worked with me, and it was great, good experience.
Well, thank you again for your service to our country in those areas as well. That is amazing. I have this feeling right now, like I should confess something. I should declare, you know, I feel like I don't want to keep anything from you. Is that a natural feeling when people talk to you?
Not anymore. But yeah, sometimes people would say things to me, like, you know, when they'd come over to give me a quote on a job, and they'd say, yeah, you know, you don't have to call my competitor because we kind of divvy up the county or whatever. I'm like, I'm not sure you should have said that to me, but your secrets are safe with me, Doc.
Okay, so good.
If there's anything you want to unburden yourself, feel free.
Well, I'll just say that I was a former assistant principal, high school assistant principal, and now I'm in HR at the district office. And so the use of the pregnant pause, I just enjoy the silence because it drives people crazy. They can't handle silence. They feel a need to fill the void. And so I find that when I'm running an investigation, if I'm quiet long enough, you know, all kinds of stuff comes out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You got to watch the body language, you know, eye contact. When somebody says, well, to be honest with you, it's like, yeah, you weren't before.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I know there's some level of confidentiality, discretion, but what was the most interesting case you worked on, either as a federal prosecutor with the Department of Justice or as Assistant Attorney General of the state of Connecticut?
Well, you know, as a supervisor, as the chief of the department, I was more supervising for the last 15 or 16 than actually, I did my fair share of cases. One of the last cases that I started was a case, I've been on 60 Minutes for one of my cases.
Pops, how far you have fallen from being on 60 Minutes to being on the John freaking Muirpod. I'm so sorry.
You know, you asked me if I'd ever been on the podcast, and I, you know, I wasn't going to say no, but I have been on CBS. Yeah, so that was an interesting case. It was it's a case. It's against a number of generic drug manufacturers, and one of the things I used to do is I was pretty good at finding cases. And I read an article in the New York Times the summer of 2014 about a couple of this one discrete drug, a generic drug that had gone up in price. And generic drugs really shouldn't be going up in price. It's a commodity. It's like water. You know, I mean, it's like your generic blood thinner and my generic blood thinner are the exact same thing. You make yours and I make. Anyways. So the only way you compete is on price. So they shouldn't be going up. They should be going down. This drug was going up. Thought it was kind of funny. Talked to my best assistant attorney general, prosecutor. We talked to the attorney general. We sent out some subpoenas. Long story short, it is now, it's going to trial soon. It is the largest domestic price-fixing case in the United States history. And so, yeah, it ended up on 60 Minutes.
Did this involve a pharma bro?
No, it's not Martin Shkreli.
Okay.
It was not him. But it's all the big companies. It's all the big generic drug companies. So what started out with three subpoenas turns into hundreds of subpoenas and a lot of documents, a lot of damning emails, phone records. Just a lot of evidence of price fixing, bid rigging, things like that. It was a cool case. But, I'm out of it now.
Yeah.
I helped start it, but the guy who did all the hard work, he's still there and he's working with a pretty big team.
Yeah. A get rich scheme based on the suffering and misery of others.
Everybody pays for generic drugs, whether you are prescribed them or not, because there's taxpayer funded programs.
Mm-hmm.
You probably have a family member. If you're not on a generic, everybody's touched by these conspiracies. Everybody.
Well, again, I feel the urge to confess that I'm on a number of generic drugs. So
you're probably a victim.
Yeah. Where do I file my claim?
Stay in touch. It's not over yet.
All right. Hey, we're going to take a quick break and hear from the sponsors. When we come back, we're going to get into some peak bagging. And we're going to spend a little time on top of Mount Washington, which I'm really looking forward to. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. This episode is sponsored by Jolly Gear. Are you tired of compromising between the ventilation of a button-down and the full protection of a sun hoodie? With the Triple Crown button-down, you can have the best of both. Plus, their fun standout patterns will have you the talk of the trail. Visit them at jollygear.com. Thru-hiker owned, Jolly Gear, where fun meets functional.
Welcome back. We were talking to Michael Cole, aka Pops or Risky, or maybe some other trail name yet to be landed upon. And we just heard about his background and his service to our country, both in the military and also in the legal department. And now we're going to move on to some adventures out there in the outdoors. And I mentioned Mount Washington before we left. Tell us about your relationship to Mount Washington, Pops.
Okay, so, I mean, Mount Washington, home of the world's worst weather. I've summited it probably close to 20 times, but it's not as boring as it sounds because there's a number of different ways to get up to Mount Washington. Some are just pretty straightforward trails up. Some are pretty sketchy trails up, like the Huntington Ravine, which I did. Matter of fact, the Huntington Ravine, I did this last summer. I think it was my second time, and that was with Stretch and the professor, among others. And I love doing it in the winter because there's no guarantee you're going to get to the summit in the winter. It's, you know, a 60 mile per hour day is kind of a nice day on Mount Washington. You know, it's, that's probably just average. I've been up there when it's been a little bit worse. And like I said, at the start, I'm kind of a small guy, so it kind of knocks, it could knock you around pretty good. But Mount Washington is just an incredible mountain. It's just a very challenging mountain, especially in the winter. It's not for the faint of heart. And I love doing it, and I love exposing people to it, bringing people up up the mountain who haven't really had that opportunity yet.
Now, how tall? What's the altitude of Mount Washington?
I think it's a drop over 6,200 feet.
6,200 feet. And so for people on the West Coast, I love the fact that, people on the West Coast, they kind of look down their noses at 6,200 feet. They got the Sierras. Right. Maybe even in Central America, so in the central U.S., in the central U.S. with the Rockies. I mean, you've got 14,000 foot peaks there. You know, they may hear Mount Washington and 6,200 feet and wonder, what is the big deal? It's only 6,200 feet. What is it about the topography there that leads to that bad of weather at the top of Mount Washington? Because you're right. It's the worst weather in the world.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, give or take, 2 weeks ago when we had that cold spell here, and I kind of traveled across the United States, I think Mount Washington was around minus 110 degrees. And I think it broke U.S. records for the coldest day of the year. I can't tell you, you know, we should have had the I could have channeled the professor because he would have told you precisely why it's the worst in the world, but it has to do with kind of where it sits and the convergence of, you know, the airflow from Canada, from the North Atlantic and the South. And it can change on a dime. It could be a bluebird day, and the next thing you know, it's sleet and freeze, you know, horizontal snow and whiteout conditions. It just, like I said before, it's like being on the moon. I would much rather hike in those. It's going to sound weird. I'd much rather kind of be up there in that kind of a condition, not all the time, than a 60 degree day where I could see 100 miles and with a light wind. Those are nice, but they're not very. There's not a lot of excitement, adventure to it, to me.
Yeah, 10-point deduction. You're now down to 64.
Yeah, I fell into that.
Yeah, but of your 20 or close to 20 times at the top of Mount Washington, did you ever take the? Let's see what it's called. It's called the Mount Washington Cog Railway.
No.
No cheating for you.
You know, here's the thing about the Cog Railway. When you're hiking down Washington on the Jewel Trail, you're hiking down the Jewel Trail, the Cog Railway is kind of coming up almost parallel to the Jewel Trail. And you have to actually cross the tracks, and they're kind of up high, so you have to like climb over them. But when the Cog Railway passes and you're hiking down, you see all the people on the Cog Railway, and they're staring out at you and they're waving to you. Like you're a celebrity, you know? And that's the thing about Mount Washington, as opposed to some of the other presidentials. You know, there's a big observatory at the top, and there's a restaurant at the top. And so you got all the guys like us, and you could drive to the top You know, there's a trailway. And so you get all these guys and we get to the top and, you know, everyone wants to take their picture on the summit. And on a nice day, not on a minus 50 degree day, but on a nice day, there's a line at the summit marker. And you've got people with flip-flops and dresses and shorts. And then, you know, us ugly, sweaty, dirty hikers are come tromping up. We got to get in line with them. And we got to wait to get our picture taken. There should be two lines. There should be a hiker line and an everybody else line, because it really pisses me off.
Yeah, there's something not right about that. I mean, you have to earn that picture.
Yeah, and earn, no offense. And for some people, they can't hike it up, so I get it. But if you get up there on the cog or you drive your Harley up, you should have to, you should wait. You should defer to the hikers. But it is cool. They're waving to you and you wave back and you feel like, you know, you're Hillary or, you know, on Mount Everest or something.
Now, Mr. Federal Prosecutor, when they wave to you from the train and you're looking back, do you actually wave back or do you give them another gesture?
No, I'm nice. I wave.
Yeah.
Or I ignore. No, usually I wave.
Yeah. Yeah. Kucharski yeah. goes the other way, right?
Kucharski, he's a scary looking dude. I met him because we both do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And the first time I met him, I looked at him, and he's like 6'3" with his long, shaggy beard. And I was like, ugh. And then he's like ripped, you know? I mean, I looked at him. He was like coming over to me. And I'm like, ooh, that guy's a scary-looking dude. And he grabs your butt with two hands, likes to shake hands with two hands. And he bends over. I'm like, okay. He's a little sweetheart, actually. But he's a scary-looking dude.
Well, we got to get you three out to the West Coast so I can have a beer with you guys. You guys sound very entertaining. And, you know, I didn't realize you also did Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I mean, the fact that you did three different warfare schools, served in the military, and now have Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I think that has to be you have to be a lethal asset out there on the rugby field.
Well, I don't play rugby anymore. There's an old boys team, but I'm too old for the old boys. But the cool thing about jiu-jitsu is I've got this whole crew from jiu-jitsu that I've turned on to hiking with me. And they're the ones who kind of gave me the Wilderness Father name. And I call them the young guns because they're all under 40. And there must be like 8 to 10 of them now, give or take. Even Kucharski, he did some hiking before me, but I'm the one who kind of rekindled his passion. So there's like, I got this whole jiu-jitsu young guns club that, like I said, like we might take them hiking and kind of a neat thing.
Nice. The Pied Piper.
I'm the Pied Piper.
That might be it.
Pops. I'm the Pied Piper going up, but I'm usually the tail end Charlie going down. They're way ahead of me.
Nice. Any tales of adventure from your many trips up to the top of Mount Washington?
Oh, tales of adventure. You know, I mean, I've been up there in times when we were I think maybe one other team summited one day. It was total whiteout conditions. It was with Jason, not Kucharski, and a couple other people. The only way we made it was because we had GPS. You couldn't use a map and a compass. You couldn't see the cairns. That was a great hike. But, you know, there's been times I've had to turn back. Probably the only times when I did Rainier, I had to turn back too. But you know, the old saying, you know, the summit is optional, getting down is mandatory. And on Washington in the winter, there's been, you know, I've probably made of my 18 or so summits, I probably attempted Washington in the winter 5 or 6 times, and I think I had to turn back twice. It was just too bad. The conditions were bad. Somebody had a couple of gear malfunctions. So nothing crazy, though. Sorry. Nothing.
That's okay. Don't apologize for a lack of craziness on top of the most dangerous mountain in the States. Maybe the world, depending on the day, right? So.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But you mentioned Rainier. Let's talk about Rainier in the state of Washington. How did you find yourself out there? Is this a trip that you had planned to get to the top of Rainier?
Right. So I took my son to Shasta when he was in high school, and he kind of has a little bit of a knack for or a desire for climbing. So when he graduated college, we decided we'd do Rainier together, but I did with a guiding company who I've used a few times. So I've done several trips out to the Cascades. And Rainier, we did the Emmons route, which is a little bit harder than the Disappointment Cleaver route. And Summit Day, you know, did an alpine start, which means, you know, you get up at like 3 in the morning, get every, you know, eat your breakfast with your headlamp on, get all roped up. Started going up, started snowing. I think we got to about 13,000, a little over 13,000 feet, and Rainier's a little over 14,000 feet. And it was it turned into like a total whiteout conditions. And the guy just said, you know what, we're turning back. It's too risky. We were, you know, we were probably an hour from the summit. So we turned back, you know, and at first I was kind of bummed about it. And, you know, so whenever this, the first thought is, all right, well, I'm coming back. I'm going to do it again, you know? And one of the guys kind of like pulled me aside and said, look, you did like 90% of the mountain. You did everything but stood on the summit. You know, if you want to come back, we'll take your money and we can do this all over again. But there's not much more you're going to get out of it. And he's right. And so I kind of moved on. You know, will I ever do it again? I don't know. There's other mountains to climb, you know? And so it was a great experience. By the time we got back down to the base, not the base camp, the next camp, that whiteout turned into just a downpour for like the next 12 hours, just in the tent, 12 hours. And it was a long 12 hours with my son, who back then didn't talk a lot in the tent. That's my Rainier story, but it's a great, I mean, it's a beautiful mountain.
I love that saying that you said, the summit is optional, getting down is mandatory. Discretion can be the better part of valor in those cases, right? Live to fight another day. How many cliches did I just use? Right, three right off the top of my head. So
hikers and mountaineers love cliches. I got a bunch of them.
Very good. Now you also mentioned Shasta. Have you done that multiple times, or just the one time with your son?
Just one time. That's a tough mountain. You know, nobody kind of. That was a steep mountain. He got a little altitude sickness that day, and. That's another 14,000 footer, glacier travel, alpine start, roped up, big crevasses. And it was in the summer. So, you know, some of these have very thin ice bridges, snow bridges, and you punch right through. And summited, headed down, and then I kind of, on Shasta, I kind of bonked on the way down. And that was probably my most scary mountaineering incident occurred on Shasta for me.
And what was that? What happened?
So heading down, it was kind of weird. I kind of, maybe I didn't eat enough or drink enough, but I was definitely running out of steam. And kind of a weird thing happened. You know, we have our ice axes, and as coming down, my son found an extra ice axe just kind of lying in the snow. So he carried it for a little while, and then he gave it to me. So I'm kind of going down with two ice axes, and I slipped and fell on my back. And when I hit the ground, I dropped one of the ice axes, but I still had another ice axe. And then I started to slide on my back, you know, head up, feet down, and I took off like a rocket. And I executed the most perfect rollover self-arrest, my only self-arrest. And The guide later told me that he saw his whole career flashing before his eyes because I stopped probably about, 20 to 30 feet from just these massive piles of rocks. It would have been bad. So luckily for me, he found that ice axe, because I don't know if I would have had an ice axe to self-rest with. And when we get to it, that will be one of my pro tip insights of the week, but we'll get there.
Always carry an extra ice axe. Never know when it's going to come in handy.
Know how to use your ice axe,
Well,
because a lot of people carry them, but they don't know how to use them.
doesn't do a lot of good if you don't know how to use it.
Looks cool.
Yes, it does look cool. Now, have you had any training or certification in any kind of mountaineering or self-arresting or anything like
Yeah,
that?
no, yeah. So I've done a lot of mountaineering schools besides the military. We weren't carrying ice axes back then, but I've done a lot of a couple schools where, we learn how to self-arrest, self-belay, build anchors, use crampons, crevasse rescue. ARRI certified level one certification for avalanche training awareness. So the interesting thing about that course is, I can't tell you how many times I probably moved through avalanche terrain and didn't know I was moving through avalanche terrain. And then once you take the course, you realize it's better to be lucky than good, but it's probably better to be smart. And so it really teaches you, I mean, it's a whole science. I mean, it is a science, and it's like there's like five levels, and I'm like at the first level. So I'm smart enough to know where to get the avalanche information if I'm traveling in the wintertime, and kind of how to understand some of the basic information, test it a little bit. And one of the reasons why I do it, one of the reasons that led me to get the avalanche certification was I'm taking out all these guys, from jiu-jitsu. They're all young guys, they have young kids. And I feel a little bit of responsibility. We were going to do a trail once called the Slide, which I've done before, which is like avalanche. It's like so prone to avalanche. And the first time I did it, I didn't even realize it. It's just this snow on top of this big slab, smooth slab on this high angle. I mean, it's just waiting for. And we were just supposed to do it with Bucharski, I don't think Jason, and a couple other guys. And I said, you know what, guys, it had snowed a lot a few days before. I said, I just don't feel comfortable doing this. And we ended up doing a different hike. And then I said, I got to take a course because these guys follow me like the Pied Piper. And I don't want to lead them into something that's going to turn into a bad day for everybody.
Yeah, another
So I've
cliche.
got some training.
Yeah, another cliche is, ignorance is bliss, right? And that stems from, in any field, there's what you know, there's what you don't know, and then there's what you don't even know that you don't know. And that's usually like a huge mountain of information that you're just completely ignorant of. You realize that there's some stuff that you don't know, but there's this whole other mountain of material that you don't even know that you don't know about it. And this what you've just described, walking happily along in perfect avalanche country, completely oblivious, thinking everything is just fine and dandy. And that's a very dangerous situation. If you are interested in activities that go to the far right side of the risk continuum, you're going to want to educate yourself so that you know what you're getting yourself into and you know what you're getting others into.
100%, that's why in the winter, I mean, like you could have avalanches in the tree line if there's enough snow and the angle's right. And you don't even think, you think about it like avalanche when it's like out in the open, but you can have it in the tree line. And putting aside the people that we talked about earlier on the podcast who have no clue and are totally unprepared, then you have the people who think they're prepared, who carry the ice axe around and wouldn't know how to use it if they had to, or travel across avalanche terrain, or forget to check the weather report. And just some simple common sense thing. Maybe I mean, if you're going to carry an ice axe, common sense things. Nowadays, if you don't have enough money or the time to go to school, get on YouTube. You know, go outside on the golf course next time it snows with your ice axe, watch a YouTube video and practice. Because I'm telling you, a lot of those people, maybe not out west, but here, who carries ice axe, I bet you they have no idea how to use it.
Okay, which brings us to the question, how do you properly use an ice axe?
Well,
We're not at the pro tip, but we're kind of jumping the gun. So if I steal your thunder here, I'll forgive it. But I think this is the logical time to talk about how do you use an ice axe
Well, I'll
correctly.
try to describe it. I mean, you want to have the ice axe in your uphill hand. So, and if you're looking to have it for what's called a self-arrest, then the way it's turned is the not the pick end. You know, the sharp end, that's facing to the rear. And the adze, that little curved blade, is facing to the front. And you're gripping it right at the stem in between the adze and the pick. And if you're going to fall on your stomach, if your feet slide out from under you, you're literally going to bring the ice axe up to your chest. So now that pick, remember the pick is facing the rear. Well, if you bring it up to your chest, now the pick is facing down. You grab what is it? Or whatever, the stem of the ice axe, the shaft, and you fall and you turn your head so you don't get hit by the ice axe, and you dig it into the ground and you pull up, and you know you make a solid contact. That's if you fall on your stomach with your head up. That's how you use an ice axe. The trick is, like I told you before, sometimes you fall on your back. Sometimes you fall on your stomach head down. Sometimes you fall on your back head down. So there's all different positions, and you got to learn how to kind of maneuver the ice axe, you know, because you don't always fall like you're going to fall on your stomach. But that's the basic way to learn is on your stomach, and it works.
So when you're driving the ice axe into the snow to self-arrest, what part of the ice axe is going in?
The pick,
The pick.
the sharp, narrow end. There's the pick, the adze, the spike, that's the pointy part on the bottom, and the shaft. And if it's really deep snow and you catch yourself really quick, you can do something called a self belay, which is when you just plant the whole ice axe, just jam it right into the snow.
Shaft first.
Shaft first, and you want to get it really deep, and that'll hold you. But if you can't do that, then and you start to slide, then it's a self-arrest situation.
Dicey stuff. Good to know. If you've got that ice axe, it's not just for looks. Know how to use
That's right.
it.
But they make great pictures on the summit when you're holding it up.
Okay.
You gotta, you know, looking good is, you know, it's part of that.
That's right. That's right. Now, Pied Piper, have you also done any hiking in Alaska?
I was up in Alaska in May of 21 for 10 days up on, it's called the Kahilna Glacier, which is in Denali National Park. It's probably about 10 miles from Denali. I did a couple mountains up there. Beautiful country, cool place. Fly in on one of those planes with the skids on the bottom, and you fly over the mountains, you fly through the mountains. It's pretty neat.
Any aspirations to do Denali eventually?
So my window for climbing Denali is probably closing, meaning I'm, you know, getting on. I mean, I think I'm still physically fit enough to do it. So, it's on the bucket list. I was actually going to do it this summer, but I might have had to for a while look like I was heading for some shoulder surgery. But I've been able to kick the can down the road and not do the surgery yet. But it's on the list. I would say it's either going to be Aconcagua, that's in Argentina. Denali, or maybe there's another mountain in Canada called Mount Logan, which is like the second highest mountain in North America. It's not as well known, it's a little more remote, and it's not as much of a scene as Denali is in the summer. Denali is like a mini Everest. You know, we could have like 50 teams on Denali in a summer, and Mount Logan might have like two. It's kind of a, yeah, so nobody knows about it, but that's on one of those three is kind of on my list.
For this summer?
No, not this summer.
It's too soon now.
Not enough time.
All right. So let's put it on the list for next summer, and let's put some pressure on Kanosh and Kacharski to get out there with you.
I also hike with Kanosh's older brother, Adam. He's a former Marine, too, our Marine. He would do it. Kacharski would, you know, he'll just run up it and run down it. And so would Jason.
There are no former Marines. They're just Marines.
Just Marines. Yeah.
That's right.
I know.
All right. Hey, tell me about the radio control tower in Alaska.
Yeah, so radio control tower, it's probably about somewhere in between, maybe it's about 8,500 feet. It's probably about 2 or 3 miles from the Hilton base camp. The Hilton base camp is where everybody starts Denali. You know, that's the long trek from. And so it's a cool little mountain. You know, you got to cross glacier to get to it. You got to cross crevasses to get to it. It's got a pretty near the summit. There's a pretty narrow kind of a ridge line to get to it. I mean, it's maybe 2 or 3 feet wide tops. You know, you can easily fall to your right or fall to your left. You're definitely roped up, but then it has a nice little flat summit. I do not know how it's got its name, but it's kind of got this cool knife edge trail leading to the summit that you definitely want to be paying attention. So it was a nice little climb, great view, beautiful. You know, we're able to see that was a bluebird day. There was not a 60-mile whiteout condition there.
So, Pops, am I to understand that there's actually no radio control tower there?
There's nothing on the summit. There's no, you know, you can't get a cup of hot cocoa.
You couldn't take the railroad. Couldn't take the railroad up there.
Yeah, I don't know how it got its name. It's kind of a. We need Jason.
The professor would tell us, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Pops, you know where we are right now?
No. We have the pro tip of the week.
The pro tip insight of the week.
That's right. You hit the nail right on the head. It's time for you to share some more trail wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So we heard about the ice axe. I apologize for stealing that thunder early. Do you have something else you want to share?
All right. So that was one of my pro tips. I don't get credit for that, right?
I told you. I would show you some grace there. I give you credit for that.
Okay. So I guess one pro tip is, I'll give you two quick ones. The first one is, again, winter hiking. And I've learned this from experience, is do not just follow when it's during a winter hike, you know, because do not assume that the tracks in front of you know where they're going. You definitely want to, if you have your GPS, if you have your map, you definitely every, you know, 15, 30 minutes, 500 yards, whatever you want to do, check where you are. Don't assume that the person in front of you knows the route, because it's happened to me and I've heard stories where that person is lost. And, you know, if you're just kind of mindlessly following the snowshoe tracks or the whatever footprints in front of you, it could be a little bit of a recipe for disaster. And it happened to me and a couple of buddies of mine, where we followed these tracks for hours. And then we came upon them in the bottom of a gully. And it was like 4 o'clock in the winter. And they turned us and said, "Do you guys have a map?" And we said, "Yeah." They said, "Good, because we're lost." So that's pro tip number two, right, or one.
That is
check
fantastic.
Your bearing.
That is fantastic. Newsflash to everybody out there that not all that you encounter are the sharpest tools in the shed in the outdoors. There's a lot of great people out there, but just following them blindly can get you into a tough spot.
Yeah, and in the winter, you know, and then it got dark on my trip, you know, and then we had to find where we were heading, which was not fun. And the other quick one is if you carry a map and know how to use the map, know how to do a resection, know how to do an intersection with your compass, know how to use it. I guess I'm a big fan of, if I'm going to carry something, I'm going to know how to use it, not just carry.
That's right. Don't just stand at the top of the summit with your ice axe in one hand and your compass and map in the other, thinking this is going to make a great photo opportunity. Know how to use those things.
Know how to use your tools.
Very good. That right those, there.
That's my pro tip.
That is the pro. That encompasses everything. So fantastic.
Good.
All right. So there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Pops. Want to thank him for joining us this week. Michael, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates about your latest adventures?
Well, that's going to be hard to do, Doc, because I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. So I guess if you wanted to friend me, I do post pictures and you know, some videos of some of these trips. Other than that,
slim pickings.
Yeah.
How about, do you have a MySpace page? Maybe something on Pinterest. I don't know.
Well, you know, if they go next time they go to the supermarket, they look on the bulletin board, maybe there'll be a little heat and some pits, and they can give me a phone call.
That's right. If you want to follow Pops, keep your eyes peeled for the cork boards for some chits that you can tear off to call in and find out what his latest adventure has been. That's
calling on that rotary phone.
Yep. On rotary phone. People are like, what's a rotary phone? So,
yeah.
All right. Hey, remember to check out the pod on social media. We do have Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakymuir@gmail.com.
The Adventure Media Recommendation.
Pops, I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, documentary, website, some kind of adventure media to keep our listeners connected to the trail. We call this our Adventure Media Recommendation. Any suggestions for us?
I mean, everybody's seen all the documentaries, the big ones. I read a book after I got back from Alaska called The Comfort Crisis. I think the author, Michael Easter, as in the holiday Easter. And it's kind of a cool book. It's really about how, to sum it up, is you need to learn to be comfortable in uncomfortable places. And it's how too much of society gets too comfortable, and you got to get out there and you got to challenge yourself. And he tells some pretty cool stories about, you know, living in Alaska for 30 days and some of the other adventures that he's done. And the whole theme is, you know, that's, you know, our ancestors were uncomfortable and they survived. And if you really want to live life, you want to get out there and be learn to be uncomfortable place. So it's a good book, The Comfort Crisis.
Love it. I think that is most appropriate. We have heard on this podcast many times from different people that the key to enduring and doing these great things is finding a way to be comfortable while being uncomfortable. You know, embrace the suck is the shorthand
embrace
version
the
of that. Yep. Okay.
Attitude determines altitude.
Very good.
What have we not asked you?
All right. And before we wrap things up, just one more segment for you called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What did we miss tonight?
I do have I allegedly have a trail named after me in Hokkaido, Japan.
Really? How did that happen?
I'm full of surprises, Doc.
You are.
So in a nutshell, in the Marine Corps, we were doing an exercise with the Japanese Self-Defense Force winter, Hokkaido, you know, where the Winter Olympics was in 1972, which I don't know if anybody's listens to who's flown by then, but anyways, I was the liaison officer. I was embedded with the Japanese, so I wasn't with the Marines. I was with the Japanese. And they did a movement to contact on this trail. I had a Marine interpreter with me and a Marine radio man. Everybody else was Japanese. And the radio man and the interpreter stayed in the Articlat. And this is like a 20-mile ski march. And I was the first American to do it. And, you know, there's a lot of like ups and downs and mountain, you know, skiing down mountains, things like that. And I got to the bottom, and there was a Marine, a Japanese general who was the general commanding the Japanese Self-Defense Force in Hokkaido. He was a three, I don't think they have stars, but whatever it was, chrysanthemums, some kind of flower. And he congratulated me. He gave me a gift, took a really cool picture. I could send it to you. With the camouflage, you know, the white camis and all that. And he said, we're going to name the trail after you. Because you're the first Marine to ever, the first American to ever do it. And, you know, I never went back and checked and if it's actually true, but that's what he said. At least that's what I heard.
So you're not sure if he was blowing smoke, but I can tell just from the way you told this story, Pops, that of all the things that you've accomplished in your life, this is one of the prouder moments.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. You know, like I said, my radio man and the other guy, they just wanted to, they had no interest in getting out of that snowcat. And I hung in there with those guys, but I had, you know, this is like a year after I went to the school in Norway, so I knew how to ski by then. I was in pretty good shape, and there was no riff, there was no effing way, excuse me, that I was riding in that snowcat. You know, I was going up that mountain, and I was going down that mountain. I fell a lot, but I did it.
You had that in your back pocket, the Norwegian training. Those Norwegians did you right.
They did.
All right. Well, hey, Michael, that is a wrap from the John Freaking Muir studio. Any shout outs to friends and family?
Sure. I'd like to give a shout out first and foremost to my wife, Carol, who lets me go on all these hikes and adventures. My kids, Amanda, Greg and Jessica, my hiking crew, the Young Guns, Matt Talbot, my son-in-law. He always has my back up in the mountains. Joseph, we talked about Mike Kucharski and Jason, Warrior Patrick, and Connor. And some of my old-time hiking buddies, Matt Budzik and Joe Chambers.
We didn't talk about it, but unfortunately, the Open Doors Outdoors, Davey Edwards, who's the executive director, who it's a nonprofit for veterans with some mental health issues, PTSD and anxiety and depression. And one of the things I do in retirement is they like to get these guys out into nature and do some hikes. And I'm one of their trip leaders for the White Mountains. I lead hikes in the White Mountains. So shout out to Open Doors Outdoors.
That's nonprofit. Fantastic. If people want to learn more about Open Doors Outdoors, where can they find more information?
Yeah, opendoorsoutdoors.org. Great organization. It really, you know, it's takes care of veterans and their families. You know, the studies have shown you know this better than I do. You get out in nature, it changes your brain, and it really is something that we see some really incredible benefits for these guys to kind of get out. We do an easy hike, we do a moderately challenging hike, and then they kind of graduate to, you know, a White Mountain hike. And I kind of lead those hikes now. So I'm lucky for me, I hooked up with them in retirement. I get to hike and I'm a vet and I can give back.
Living the dream. Thank you so much for that, Michael.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. Doesn't care if you want to go downhill. Doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you have to stand behind the guy in flip-flops as you wait your turn for a picture at the summit. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck. Thank you.